because Bean needs me. So I do something incredibly stupid. I put my hand on Billy's ankle and try to shake him awake. At first, nothing happens, and then all at once he comes back to life. He grabs my hair with one hand and sticks a splat gun in my face. His terrible dark voice goes, "Who disturbs me? Who dares make Billy unhappy?" I'm too scared to speak. I've seen what his gun can do and how it got its name. "Speak," says Billy. "Speak to me, or the last sound you'll hear will be splat." "It's me," I say. "Spat." "Impossible," Billy says, pressing the gun into my forehead as he slides back the trigger guard. "The spaz boy is too frightened to show his face down here. You're an imposter." "My sister," I tell him. "My sister is sick. I have to see her." "You lie. The spaz boy has no sister. We're not blood, but she's still my sister." He's staring at me as if I'm not quite real, as if I'm something that came from the probe he was watching. But then his eyes sort of flicker, and I know he recognizes me. Slowly, he takes the splat gun away from my forehead. "It is you," he says. "What happened to give you courage?" "Bean," I say, "I heard she was sick." He thinks about it, then shrugs. "Most unfortunate, but as you say, this girl is no blood of yours." "She asked for me," I tell him. "They live on the other side of the herb. I need your help. I need safe passage." I beg, I plead, but Billy Bismo sits like a stone, a cold stone with dead eyes. He could care less what I want, or if Bean lives or dies. There will be no safe passage, and I am forbidden to leave. "Hear me, spaz boy," he says. "No one leaves my latch without my permission, and that includes you. Too bad for your little friend, but people die every day, every hour, every minute. So put it out of your mind. There's nothing you can do about it." "Billy, please." He places the splat gun under my nose. "Billy," says, "no," he whispers. "If you ask again, you die. Is that clear?" "Yes, Billy." "Good," he says. "Now what are the rules?" "Always believe Billy, always obey Billy, always speak true to Billy." "Most excellent," he says, again. By his command, I repeat his rules. Believe, obey, speak true. But inside my head, I'm already running away. Chapter 8. The Smell of Lightning. Once when she was 8 years old, Bean almost died. They said she had the bone marrow sickness, and her blood was so weak it couldn't keep her alive. Her eyes had this going away look, and all she could do was lie in her bed and tremble. She couldn't eat or sleep, and everything hurt, from her skin all the way down into her bones. Nothing helped until this old woman came, a healer. The healer passed her hands over Bean and said she might live or she might die, but the only thing that might save her was a special remedy to strengthen her blood. The remedy was this gooey liquid stuff that smelled awful and tasted worse, and I was the only one who could get Bean to take it. If her mom or dad tried to spoon it into her mouth, she'd spit it out. But for me, she'd make a face and swallow the stuff. She was too weak to speak, so I'd tell her all these dumb little stories I made up about how she was always stopping me from doing stupid things, which was pretty close to the truth. And sometimes she'd smile and doze off for a little while. For the whole time she was sick, I stayed with her and slept on the floor by her bed, because I had this weird idea that if I ever left her side, she wouldn't be there when I got back. It scared me worse than her dying, that she might just disappear. Charlie said it was unnatural, my not wanting to leave her room, but Kay, my foster mom, said, "Let the boy be. Can't you see he makes her smile?" Then one morning when I woke up and looked over, Bean was sleeping peacefully, and the color was back in her cheeks. Either the remedy worked or Bean had gotten better on her own. I was so happy it felt like my head would explode. And then when I ran to tell everyone the good news, I must have got so excited it brought on a seizure. I remember shouting, "She's better, she's better!" And then it hit me and the blackness rose up. When I came out of it, my foster mom said it was true. Bean was much better. But Charlie said, "That's it. He's not going into a room anymore. What if he pitched a fit and hurt our little girl?" From that day, Charlie always looked at me different. as if I'd turned into someone he didn't know, even though they'd raised me almost since I was born. None of that matters now, not what Charlie thinks or me losing my family unit or anything. The only important thing is how to get to Bean so I can make her take the remedy. I don't care how many times she spits it out, I'll just keep trying until she makes a funny face and swallows the stuff. So I go back to my crib, throw a few things in my carry bag, fill my pockets with the goodies the Proof Girl gave me, and head out before anyone tries to stop me. One thing I know for sure, there's no way to get through the main part of the latch. The bangers are everywhere, and they'll be on the lookout for me to make sure I don't disobey Billy's orders. My only chance is out along the edge. Night falls before I get there, which means I have to find my way through the stacks in the dark. I don't want to waste the power in my microflash because there'll be no place to recharge it, not where I'm going. So I stumble along, bumping into piles of old bricks and junk so useless even the stack boxers threw it away. Trying to remember where the pipe is from here because the old water pipe points to the edge. A few small fires glow near the stacks, probably fired up to keep the wild dogs away. I'd love to warm my hands over the flames and rest for a while, but there's no time for taking my ease, not until I get clear of Billy's latch. As I turn to go, Littleface finds me in the dark. "Chucks," he cries, and hugs my leg. When my heart finally comes unstuck from my throat, I go, "Don't you know it's dangerous out here? Where do you live? Who looks out for you?" But all the little guy will say is, "Chucks, Chucks." So what choice do I have? I give him my last Chucks bar and take his hand and walk him toward the fires, hoping the stack people will know where he belongs. I'm also hoping that old geese rider won't be there because he'll want to talk about Bean, and that's the last thing I need right now. Talking won't help. I have to get to her. The people tending the fire back away, blending into the shadows, waiting for me to make a move. When they see Littleface holding my hand, a few of them come forward, showing off crude shetty blades made from the rusted steel wreckage that lies all around the stack boxes. Mostly the boxers look ragged and broke down somehow, as if they always expect to lose, and even though the odds are 10-1, they seem to be more scared of me than I am of them, which is just fine with me. "Go away," this one old woman screeches. "Leave the boy alone." "Stand down," I say, raising up my hands. "I brought the kid back, understand? Now I'll be on my way." Littleface finishes the Chucks bar and prances around by the fire, grinning and spoofing without saying a word. No one comes forward to claim him, but he seems to know the people there. Then as I turn to go, a voice pipes up. "Who are you gonna bust down this time, banger? Another old gummy?" I figure don't even turn around, just keep going before the darkness gives them courage and they decide to charge me with their rusty old shetty blades. "Look at him go, the big bad bully banger," crows the taunting voice. "He ain't so brave at night, is he? None of his gang to help him now, is there?" I can hear them moving behind me, but I don't look back. I'm thinking, you blew it, you mope. You ripped them off and then came back alone in the dark. What did you expect? "Get him," somebody yells. "Cut his red." Most days I can outrun just about anybody, but this isn't most days. It's the darkest part of the night, and the ground is strange under my feet. Almost before I get going, something trips me hard, and suddenly I'm flat on my face, surrounded. "Don't let him get away. Bust him down and see how he likes it." They're all around me, but keeping their distance, as if afraid that I'll strike back. Maybe they think I've got a splat gun hidden in my carry bag, or a stun stick or something. If they knew all I had was an old microflash and a few edibles, they'd swarm over me in an instant. "Cut his red! Cut his red!" shouts the boxer who started it. He's hanging back, this scrawny mope with a scraggly beard and crazy burning eyes. Even in the dark, I can see the spit flying out of his mouth as he screams for them to cut me. "Get up!" another one of them shouts. I get slowly to my feet, holding my hands to show I haven't any weapons. I'm trying to think of what to say that will make them let me go when a terrible feeling starts to come over me. "No," I say to myself, "please, not now." But I can't keep it from happening, no matter how hard I try. It always begins this way. First, the smell of lightning fills my nose, the clean electric smell of the air after a thunderstorm, and then the blackness rises up and takes me down. When I come out of it, Ryder is there, holding a damp cloth to my forehead. I'm in his stack box. They must have carried me here. I certainly didn't walk. You're okay, he tells me. It's over. Like always, I'm exhausted and weak and ashamed. I hate it when someone sees me like this. A grand mal seizure, Ryder says. Very impressive. I tried to put a stick between your teeth and you bit it in half. That explains my sore teeth. I have that familiar dreamy feeling that always comes afterward. And more than anything, I want to sleep and forget. But then it comes back to me like a splash of cold water on my brain, and I sit up and say, I've got to go. What hour is it? The hour before dawn, Ryder says. What's your hurry? I'm trying to stand up, but my legs are too weak to make it. Rest, he says. And old as he is, Ryder easily holds me down. He doesn't understand why I can't stay, so I tell him about Bean and how I have to leave before Billy Bismo reaches out and stops me. Ryder listens, and his ancient eyes go soft. Then he nods and says, now it all makes sense. I'm not sure that anything makes sense, but I haven't got the strength to argue. Tired, so tired. Sleep, he urges me. We leave at dawn. I fight to stay awake, but my eyes close on their own, and in three deep breaths, I'm fast asleep. When the old man wakes me, the sky is pale gray and so low you can almost reach out and touch it. Time to go, he says, nudging my shoulder. The bangers are looking for you. That startles me wide awake. How do you know? I ask. He shrugs. I told you before. Bad news travels fast out here near the edge. Have you recovered? Are you ready? He's got a ragged old sack strapped to his back and a long, crooked stick to help him walking. You can't come with me, I tell him. And why is that? You'll slow me down. I have to move fast. Ryder raises his walking stick and pokes me in my stomach hard enough to get my attention. Listen, young fool. We haven't much time, so I won't waste any of it being polite. I already saved your life once. That little mob would have torn you apart if I hadn't intervened. So what happens the next time you have a seizure and no one's there to keep you safe? I shove this stick away. I'll take care of myself. His tone softens. Think about it, son. You can't do this thing alone. Cross three latches without a guide, you'll be dead before sundown, or wish you were. I'm shrugging on my carry bag, edging to the door of his miserable little stack box. What do you care? Why do you always want to help me? The old man raises his stick and bars the door, like he's buying time while he thinks about his answer. Two reasons, he says after a pause. First, I want to know how your story ends, and second, this will be my last opportunity for great adventure. A mission to save the life of a beloved young woman? What more can an old man want? I shall accompany you, and then write our tale of courage in my book. You're crazy, I warn him. You might be killed. Crazy? He laughs and shakes his head. They said Don Quixote was crazy, too. Who's Don Quixote? I ask. A man who believed in doing the right thing, even if it cost him his life, Ryder says. He shoves me out the door. Come on, boy. Let me show you the way. And he marches into the daylight with his puny walking stick raised like a mighty sword. Chapter 9. By the edge we travel, by the edge we live or die. Little Face tries to follow us. He's running along, leaping from one junk pile to the next, making a game of it. Chocks, he sings out, chocks. He knows I haven't got any more. It's like he gets as much pleasure out of saying the word as eating the actual chocks bar. You made a friend, Ryder says, grinning at me. But he knows the little boy can't come with us, that it's much too dangerous. He signals to Little Face and the kid dances up to him. Ryder has a word in his ear. A moment later, the kid sings chucks one last time and then runs back in the direction of the stacks. It's a relief, but at the same time, I'm already sort of missing the little pest. There are thousands like him, Ryder comments as we pick up our pace. Orphaned or abandoned, fending for themselves. Very few live to be as old as you, let alone as ancient as me. A great writer once wrote of a very similar situation in a city called London. His name was Charles Dickens, and he too was an epileptic. That's it. I stop in my tracks. Ryder looks at me with concern. Something wrong? He asks. Shut up about the spaz, okay? I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to talk about it. And you don't want to think about it, Ryder adds. Fine, agreed. I shall not speak of the innumerable famous and successful human beings who shared your condition. I shall not speak of Julius Caesar, Napoleon Bonaparte, Leonardo da Vinci, Agatha Christie, Lewis Carroll, or Harriet Tubman. I will never again mention Joan of Arc, Vincent van Gogh, Sir Isaac Newton, Alfred Lord Tennyson, Edgar Allan Poe, or the great Paganini. Done. Finished. My lips are zipped. The old man looks really pleased with himself and then gestures with his walking stick. Proceed. Lead on. I go, I thought you knew the way. He shrugs. This is your mission. Have you a plan? You know I don't. Ah, he says. Then may I suggest we travel by the pipe? Like I mentioned before, the pipe runs out to the edge of the known world and keeps on going. They say it runs all the way into the Badlands, where the radiation will rot your bones. But what I didn't know, until Ryder tells me, is that parts of the pipe branch off and run between the latches. All part of the greatest water supply system ever devised, he says, leading us under the ruins of the giant pipe, which is supported by crumbling concrete pylons. A masterpiece of hydraulic engineering, he says. It would still be functional, except the main source of water dried up after the big shake. They tried various other solutions for a century or so, at enormous expense, but nothing worked out. And in the long run, it fell into disrepair. He loves to rattle on with all his back-timer talk, and I'm willing to listen if he can really help me find Bean. And he's right about the pipe. I have to help him climb up the side of the pylon because the old iron stairs are partly rusted away. And when we get to the pipe itself, you can see where one of the access panels has been unbolted. There, says Ryder. Whew, I was a much younger man the last time I climbed this high. Go on, check it out. I slip through the opening. There's plenty of room to stand up inside if you don't mind being ankle deep in smelly old rainwater. Shafts of light come through where bolts have rusted out, and it makes the whole pipe look shot full of bullet holes. Hey, I shout. And my voice sounds like it echoes all the way to the next latch. Ryder crawls into the pipe and sits panting, out of breath. You'll never make it, I tell him. We got miles and miles to go. I'll make it, he gasps. I've got a book to finish. I stare at him, huddled there, his frayed leggings soaking up the puddle of rainwater. No one cares about your old book, I tell him. Let's go. Right, he says, using his walking stick to get himself standing. Ready, I say, feeling bad for yelling at the old gummy. Ready as I'll ever be. He looks around and seems to like what he sees. By the edge we travel, son, by the edge we live or die. He makes everything sound so noble and grand, but the truth is we're a couple of nobodies hiding inside a rusty old water pipe, just us and the pale rats that scurry ahead. We slop along in the dead water for a while, and then we come to a part that's dry underfoot, which is easier going. Ryder is breathing better now, and he looks stronger than I would have thought possible. Maybe he'll make it after all. 7 miles, more or less, he says, keeping up with me. That'll bring us to the next latch. You've done this before? I ask. Oh, yes, he says, years ago. Certain people took a dislike to me, and I thought it best to move along. Many refugees used the pipe in those days to move around the city. Now it seems to have been forgotten, like so many other things. We plod on. There's nowhere to go but straight ahead. Small red eyes watch us, keeping their distance. I'm not afraid of rats, not while I'm awake. Sleeping, that's different. They say a rat will eat your nose before you can wake up. Eat it before you can smell them. Teeth so sharp you don't feel a thing until too late. Why do the bangers care if you leave? Ryder wants to know. I explain what Billy said about how no one could go anywhere without his permission. What I don't understand is why the gang leader focused on you in particular, Ryder says. I shrug and say, he took an interest. Exactly, Ryder says, nodding to himself. But why? I can tell he doesn't expect me to come up with an answer that he's really asking himself, but it borks me off that he thinks I'm not important enough to matter. Ryder sees the look on my face and gives my arm a reassuring squeeze. Something to ponder, son. I mean no disrespect. But sometimes it can be useful, not to say life-saving, to understand why Latch Boss does what he does. I have an idea that Mr. Bismo knows something we don't. He had a specific reason for forbidding your departure. If we can figure out what it is, it may help us get where we're going. Yeah, that's what you think, I say. Well, here's what I think. Trying to read Billy's mind will get us canceled. That shuts the old geese up, and we trudge along in silence for a couple of miles. We come to a part in the pipe that sags, which means the rainwater is collected knee-high. The water is slimy and buzzing with mosquitoes. But Ryder doesn't hesitate. He wades through it like he could care less about the wet or the bugs or the slithery things that slip along the edges. The weirdest thing about him, though, is how he doesn't seem to get mad at me when I'm mad at him. Like he expects me to be borked about stuff and doesn't take it personally. Later on, when we stop to rest for a few minutes, I share some of the edibles with him. He looks the stuff over and goes, "This is proof food, right?" So I tell him about the proof girl and he says, "Dangerous. Contact with the genetically improved is exceedingly dangerous. Not for them, for us. We're what they used to be, and they hate us for it." He eats the proof food, though, every crumb, and then we're on our way. We walk and walk until the daylight fades, and the darkness makes the pipe seem even bigger and longer, and the red eyes are closer. We walk until we feel wind in our faces. And that's when Ryder stops and says, "We've come to the break." The break? A section of the pipe is missing up ahead. We'll have to go to ground for a mile or so. I walk out to where the pipe ends, but it's so dark I can't see all the way to the ground. It feels like we're floating in the sky, and that makes me dizzy, so I back carefully away until the rusty steel is more or less solid under my feet. "How do we get down?" I ask. "We'd better wait until daylight," Ryder suggests. "No sense coming this far and then breaking our necks, is there?" It drives me crazy not to keep moving, but I know he's right about waiting. I can't save Bean if I'm busted up, that's for sure. So we crouch at the curve of the pipe and take turns trying to sleep. "You go first," he says. "I'll entertain our little friends." He tosses a pebble at the red eyes and they scurry back out of range. "Pleasant dreams," he says. And I'm thinking, right, like I'm really gonna fall asleep in a rat-filled pipe. But the next thing I know, he's shaking me and whispering, "Wake up, they're coming." I hear it. Shick-a-tick-tick, shick-a-tick-tick. The sound gets closer and closer. Something is coming down the pipe to get us. Chapter 10. Attack of the Monkey Boys. Shick-a-tick-tick, shick-a-tick-tick. I'd give anything for a Shetty blade or a splat gun, but all I've got is my carry bag. Better than nothing, but just barely. It has a rope loop on it so I can swing it when the thing comes within range. Thing because it doesn't sound human. Too delicate and steady to be the bangers. Too large and loud to be a rat. Unless it's a rat the size of a wild dog. Just thinking about that makes me shrink up inside myself. Ryder and I are both hugging the curved wall of the pipe in hopes that whatever it is will go right by us. Shick-a-tick, tick. No such luck. It's slowing down. I'm staring into the dark so hard it feels like my eyes are bugging out. Tick, tick, closer and closer until it sounds like I could reach out and touch it, or it could reach out and touch me. The shadows move, and I see it has the shape of a hunched-up monster. It spots me or senses me somehow and veers in my direction. Tick, tick. Must be talons dragging, claws as sharp as needles. Icy water floods through my guts. My heart slams. I've forgotten how to breathe. The thing is reaching out for me. I rear back with the carry bag and start to swing with all my strength. "Chucks," the monster says. Just what we need tagging along, a 5-year-old kid who only knows one word. What happened is Little Face found himself a walking stick like Ryder's and dragged it along, shick-a-tick-tick. We're stuck with him because there isn't time to take him back, or anybody there to keep him even if we did. It seems like no matter what I do, the kid keeps finding me in the dark. I figure it's the gummy's fault somehow. If you hadn't come along, the little brat would still be there, I tell him. You're the one who fed him, Ryder says. The poor child has been hungry all his life, so it's no wonder he's fastened on you, Mr. Chalksbar. The gummy speaks true, but that doesn't make me feel any less angry. Why should I care what happens to the little brat if nobody else does? Don't be discouraged, Ryder says. The child can look out for himself. That's how he survives. Running a latch is hard enough alone, I remind him. With three, it's impossible. Oh, says Ryder, raising his feathery white eyebrows. So you're an experienced latch runner, are you? The way he looks at me makes me want to tell the truth. I've never left the latch, I admit. Not since they brought me here. Then perhaps you'll take my word for it. What we're attempting to do is far from impossible. Dangerous, yes, but hardly impossible. After all, a runner crossed three latches to get the message to you, didn't he? If he can do it, so can we. And with three of us, we're less likely to be mistaken for professional runners or smugglers. What he says makes sense, although I hate to admit it. I'm out of Chalks bars, but I give Little Face a chunk of Prove edibles, and he gobbles it down like he's starving, flashing a smile that eats up his whole face. We wait until the sky is all the way light, and then check out the end of the pipe. There's no stairway, but Ryder figures we can skinny down the pylon somehow. We haven't much choice, he says. We'll have to risk it. As it turns out, Little Face shows us the way. He slips over the edge and then crawls down, using the rusty steel bars that stick out of the concrete. About 10 seconds later, he's standing on the ground below, shouting, Chalks! Chalks! Which I guess is his name for me, or maybe just a way of saying, I did it! Ryder's saggy old face is pale and worried, but I know better than to say anything. He goes next, and it takes him a lot longer than Little Face, but he manages to get down without breaking any bones. Now they're both looking up at me. Come on, Ryder calls out. You can do it. I think about Bean, how she's waiting for me, and how it doesn't matter if I'm scared of heights. About halfway down, my feet slip, and I have to hug the concrete to keep from falling. Don't move, I'm thinking. If you move, you fall. You're almost there, Ryder says, right below me. Reach down with your right foot. I do what he says, and he keeps telling me where to put my feet, and after about 1,000 years, I make it all the way to the ground and stand there shaking. What if the spaz had hit me, I say, more to myself than anybody else. It didn't, Ryder says, and we don't have time to worry about things that didn't happen. We better get a move on. It's a 2-hour hike to the next section of the pipe, assuming it's still there. What? I say with a gasp. You don't know? The last time I came this way was many years ago, he admits. Things change. You never know a thing for certain until you've seen it with your own eyes. What I do see is pretty amazing. In this latch, the old scrapers come all the way out to the edge. They say in the back times the scrapers were made of glass, giant glass buildings 100 stories high, maybe more. They say people went inside the glass buildings, traveling up and down in electric boxes. And that toward the end, the people never came out or walked on the ground, but lived and died inside. The scrapers are just twisted steel skeletons now, enormous, eerie-looking things that disappear somewhere up in the smog. Tons and tons of crumbled concrete surround the base of each scraper, stuff that must have fallen when the big shake rocked the world and split open the earth and dried up the rivers and stuff. When the light hits it, the wreckage glitters like diamonds. But Ryder says that's only chunks of broken glass, and that many a man has died looking for treasure that doesn't exist. The only real treasure is inside your head, he says, tapping the side of his skull. Memories are better than diamonds, and nobody can steal them from you. Staring up at the scrapers makes me feel extra small. Why did they build them so high, I ask him. Because they could, I guess. But weren't they afraid of earthquakes? Not afraid enough, he says. I don't suppose anybody really knows how bad a thing can be until it actually happens. The sun is barely visible through the smog, but Ryder says if we keep it over our left shoulders and walk straight ahead, we'll get where we're going, no problem. We trudge along for a couple of hours, and in all that time we don't see another living thing. No weeds, no insects, nothing. Just ruins melting into dead sand. Not even the rats are dumb enough to live this close to the edge, which is fine with me. We seem to be alone, but I keep getting this creepy feeling that something is watching us. Maybe the scrapers themselves. I don't know if the old buildings can see or not, but they sure can moan when the wind goes through the steel, moaning like they know they're slowly dying and can't do anything about it. As it turns out, the pipe is right where Ryder thought it was, sitting up there on its crumbling pylons, ready to take us where we're going. We're almost there when the howling starts.
Ahee, hoo hoo! Ahoo, yip yip!
It sounds like wild animals, but somehow I know it isn't, not exactly. Little Face hugs my leg. I can feel him shivering, which scares me almost as much as the howling.
Ahee, hoo hoo! Ahoo, yip yip!
They come pouring out of the ruins, howling and scampering and waving their arms. Monkey boys, says Ryder, don't move. They swarm in, surrounding us, and I can see their faces painted to look like monkeys and their wild eyes that want to kill us. Chapter 11. Mongo the Magnificent. Monkey boys. I've heard of them. Monkey boys control this latch like the bully bangers control theirs. But the creatures pouring out of the ruins no longer act human. They become as wild as the paint on their faces, and it isn't only the face paint. Their teeth have been sharpened into fangs, and their fingernails are like yellowed, curving claws. Something's wrong, Ryder hisses to me. No kidding, I hiss right back at him. As the crazy clawed hands reach out to grab us, Ryder twists around and looks me in the eye. Do not resist, he warns. They'll tear us limb from limb. I figure that may happen anyway, but fighting won't do any good. There's way too many of them and not enough of us. I try to keep hold of Little Face, but as the swarm lifts us, he gets separated. The little guy yells, Chalks! Chalks! And it means help me. But I can't help him, or Ryder, or myself, because we're being carried away by 100 howling madmen with ferocious snapping fangs. I'm thinking the bangers never act like this, not even when they're canceling a victim. But the monkey boys don't seem to have a leader making rules and telling them what to do. The old gummy's right. Something is wrong. The monkey boys don't just look like animals and act like animals. They've become animals. The screaming swarm carries us back into the ruins, under the long steel shadows of the giant scrapers, to a place where the air smells of blood and rust. They bring us to a strange dark structure, a fortress made from the iron bones of a fallen building. Great iron beams hammered into the ground and bound together with woven steel cable. Splat guns and cannons stick from slots in the walls. The swarm of wild monkey boys surrounds the fort, leaping and howling. Ahee, hoo hoo, ahee, yip yip. The howling becomes a word. Mongo, they howl. Mongo, Mongo, Mongo. They keep screaming for Mongo until a section of the great iron wall is lowered by cable and we're carried into the fort. The entire swarm tries to get inside, but a squad of techs is guarding the fort, and the techs hold their ground, chopping at the mob with shetty blades and stun sticks, driving them back. The monkey boys drop us to the dirt and back away. The great door is raised behind us, shutting out the swarm, and for the first time since we've been seized, the howling stops. For some reason, the quiet is even more terrifying. The techs point their weapons at us and indicate that we get up. Ryder can barely stand, but he waves me off when I try to help him. Show neither aggression nor fear, he whispers to me urgently. Just play along. Play along? I have no idea what the old man is talking about. How do you play along with a dozen armored thugs who communicate by grunts? The best I can do is keep Little Face close by as the techs herd us deeper into the fortress. The smell is terrible and gets worse. No plumbing, obviously. Very little power because the lights keep flickering. Whoever is in charge of this place, he's not paying attention, that's for sure. We pass a stockade crammed with prisoners who stare at us with dead eyes. They're all bone thin, wearing tattered rags. They don't even have the strength to moan or beg for help or keep themselves clean. A good sign, Ryder says out of the side of his mouth. A good sign? The old gummy must be losing it. But then I realize what he's getting at. If they keep prisoners, that means their victims aren't canceled immediately, which means we might have a chance to survive, at least for a while. The techs shove us down dark, winding passageways, and we make so many turns there's no way I could find my way back, even if we did manage to escape. As it turns out, we hear Mongo before we see him. A loud voice booms through the passageway. Hear Mongo and obey. Hear Mongo and obey. Over and over, like an old 3D stuck on replay, which as it turns out is pretty close to the truth. When we get closer to the booming voice, lights begin to glow, reflecting off the walls. Then at last we turn the corner, and there he is. To your knees, the tech boss shouts, shoving us down with his stun stick. Pay homage to Mongo the Magnificent. Hear him and obey. We drop to our knees and look up at Mongo. He's a fierce, powerful-looking latch boss, with bright, blazing eyes, huge, muscular arms, shoulder-length hair the color of midnight, and a snarling, blood-red monkey tattooed on his enormous chest. He thumps the tattoo with his fists and goes, "Hear Mongo and obey. Hear Mongo and obey." It's crazy, but I almost laugh out loud. Mongo the Magnificent is nothing more than a hologram. A short loop from a 3D, repeating over and over again. It wouldn't fool a 2-year-old kid, and it doesn't fool me. Ryder murmurs, "I'm gonna try something. Whatever you do, don't interfere." Before I can stop him, the old gummy stands up slowly, leaning on his stick. "On your knees," the tech boss commands. "Homage to Mongo." All the weapons aim at Ryder. It's hard to tell with the mask they wear, but the techs look nervous, uncertain. "You must take us to the real Mongo," Ryder tells them, raising his voice to be heard over the sound of the repeating hologram. "Knees," cries the tech boss. "Homage." But he sounds uncertain. "Does Mongo live?" Ryder demands. "Mongo lives," says the tech boss. He sounds puzzled, as if he's not quite sure why he's talking to the old gummy instead of canceling him. Ryder walks up to the tech boss. I'm sure he's about to die, but the tech boss doesn't move. "Take off the mask," Ryder suggests. "Let me see your face." Much to my amazement, the tech boss takes off his armored security mask. Under the mask, he's just another young guy with a round face and worried eyes. And he's looking at Ryder like he can't decide. Should he listen to the old man or cut his red? "You must take us to Mongo," Ryder tells him. "Maybe we can help." The tech boss hesitates, and his face gets all wrenched up like he's in pain. "I don't have the authority." "Does anyone have the authority?" Ryder gently asks. "No, I thought not." "Think about it, son. What would Mongo want you to do?" "Hear him and obey," the tech boss responds instantly. "Yes, of course," Ryder says patiently. "And you've done a splendid job of obeying him under very difficult circumstances, keeping your squad together, defending the fort, and so on. But now you must do more. You must help Mongo. Take us to him."
I'm afraid," the tech boss stammers.
"We're all afraid," Ryder says soothingly. "If the situation continues, the fort will be overwhelmed and you will all be destroyed. I think you know that. Something must be done." The tech boss speaks uneasily, as if afraid of being overheard. "What you say is true, but what would you have us do?" "Let's start with trying to help Mongo, shall we?" Ryder suggests. The poor tech boss looks like he's being tortured, but finally he nods and goes, "Follow me. But if we all die, don't say I didn't warn you." Warning acknowledged, Ryder says. Now proceed. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever witnessed. An old gummy, an intruder into the latch, persuading a tech boss to disobey his orders. When I look at Ryder, it's like he knows what I'm thinking, because he gives me a wink and makes it clear that we just go along while we've got the chance. Chalks? Littleface asks, tugging at my leg. Shh, I tell him, we'll be okay. And for the first time since the monkey boys grabbed us, I really do think we might make it out alive. Of course, I'm assuming Ryder intends to overpower the young tech boss when we get the chance, and then shoot our way out of the fortress. As it turns out, he's got an entirely different plan. The crazy old fool really does want to see Mongo, the real one, not the hologram version. We follow the frightened tech boss into a much smaller passageway, barely room to move, really, and then up a set of metal ladder steps. At the top of the stairs, the tech boss glances furtively around, takes a deep breath, and then wrenches open the lock on an overhead hatch. He gives Ryder a mournful look, then cautiously pushes open the hatch. Inside, he whispers. Without hesitation, Ryder climbs up the last few rungs of the ladder and disappears through the hatch. What choice do I have? I follow him inside, into the secret lair of Mongo the Magnificent, boss man of the Monkey Boys. Chapter 12. The Problem with Looping. The first thing I notice is the horrible stink. Think of moldy dead rats and rotten eggs and dirty diapers. This is worse, much worse. After crawling up through the hatch, I roll to one side and wait for my eyes to adjust to the glittery dimness. Except for the stink, it reminds me of Billy Bismo's place, only bigger. A latch boss pleasure crib stuffed with goodies and gizmos and every possible gaming device. There are lots of soft inflatos that mold themselves to your shape when you sit down, and thick massage rugs that rub your feet while you walk, and all kinds of beautiful polished things. A lot of it isn't quite real. The glowing fish that swim in a hollow aquarium, the 3Ds of female dancers that float above a projection table, wiggling their arms and legs and dancing to music I can't hear. The stink is real, though. Real enough to make your eyes water. Try not to breathe through your nose, Ryder advises. I can tell from his expression that he's not terribly surprised by what he sees or smells. I follow him to the center of the room, where we find a kind of huge round bed that seems to be the source of the horrible stink. Imagine a throne made of thick sleeping mats, and you've got the idea. The poor wretch, Ryder says softly. Lying on the bed throne is a shriveled, starving creature, soaked in his own filth. Most of his hair has fallen out and lies in a fuzzy pile around his head. His teeth are gone, and his eyes are milky blind. I can barely make out the faded red monkey tattoo on his withered chest. At first glance, you might think he's dead, but he isn't. Not quite. His fingers twitch a little, and his mouth works as if he's trying to speak. And you can see where veins pulse weakly in his scrawny neck. A faint sound comes from his ruined mouth. Like the noise of a small motor running out of power. Amber lights slowly blink on the silver boxes of the mind probe machinery, going bzz, bzz, bzz. I get the idea the thing in the bed is trying to talk to the probe machine, or thinks the probe is talking to him, something like that. The weird thing is, the filthy, bone-starved creature seems to be smiling, as if unaware of his condition. What happened to him? I ask. The young tech boss has worked up the courage to follow us into the room. Mongo has been looping